Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 8th, 1999. In the Creekside Room this morning is our presenter, Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. Families in Crisis, Violence, Popeye God.
What to do about it. And how many of you have been to the other sessions? So almost all of you. So we really probably don't need to repeat this very much, except for to reiterate the important point that I'm trying to make, which is that from my vantage point, it's very important that we look at what is happening within families themselves, and that if things aren't going well within a family structure, if you have a great deal of violence or alcoholism or abuse or just the absence of people being around because parents are working too much or whatever, that's very important in terms of children. The neighborhood is really a critical issue of the surroundings in which families are trying to make it. And then yesterday we focused on the third circle, which is the society one, with an emphasis really on what's going on in the economy and taxes. And we saw that the trends in the United States are towards really a dramatic division between rich and poor, that division is expanding very fast in this country, more rapidly here than any other country, so that the top 1% of our people have a net worth greater than 90% of U.S. citizens. And I try to make a case that gets reflected or is partly caused by changes in the tax system that were embraced, that were pushed forward by Republicans, but also embraced by a Democratic Congress, which raises a lot of questions about representative democracy, whose voices are being represented. And one statistic that I didn't give you, but I think it's an interesting one, when I was asking for solutions, what could we do differently if we wanted to try to respond to some of the economic divide that impacts families? One of them is probably campaign finance reform. So for example, the statistic I have is that I think it's 37% of all money involved in federal campaigns. So 37% of all the money involved in federal campaigns are given by 0.1% of the U.S. population. So 0.1% of significant contributors, I think, have a very powerful impact on what voices get heard and don't get heard in Washington. And the other very important claim I was trying to make is that I'm trying to get us to think about poverty, if poverty is a key factor in influencing how well children do or do not do. It's not the only factor. We talked about the poverty of affluence, but we also, I think, people really presented some very good and thoughtful information yesterday as we tried to think about, boy, how complicating would it be to be trying to live on that one footline income of a minimum wage worker. We can understand, but I wanted us to see that poverty is quite expansive in our country. That it's not primarily people who are on welfare who are even poor. That in the last two decades, what we see is a dramatic increase in the working poor. So that we have, as I mentioned, about 1 out of every 5 full-time workers in our country are living in poverty. So that's why those wage issues become so important and why public support issues in terms of things like healthcare, daycare, or housing become so important, because based on minimum wages and with the fact that many corporations are either downsizing or what they're doing is in the new contracts that they hire with a lot of their workers is they're not providing benefits. I mentioned yesterday that 80% of the uninsured in our country are people who work. So their jobs are not providing them with health insurance. So that was the picture that we tried to look at yesterday. And today, what I want to examine more are the cultural influences. And here's where, as a parent, Sarah's here too, quite frankly, I feel, as a parent, that I'm up against enormous odds Because the values that I hold and the values that I'm trying to teach my children are undermined in almost every way, I would say, by the culture. And so what I'd like to talk about, I'd like to talk about that first of all, and I'd just like to open it up and hear some of your comments. And if possible, some of you, I'm in a family of all girls. I have three daughters. Some people here are mixed families. Some of you are young men and young women. But if you could talk a little bit, when you share your insights or your questions, it would be helpful for me if you said, boy, in trying to raise daughters in this culture, or trying to be a young woman in this culture, the cultural images that get in the way, or that I find problematic, are, or in trying to raise sons, or in being a young man or a young boy in this society, the pressures from the culture, the images from the culture say this and that, and I find those troubling. Now, some of them may be very similar, but some of them may be quite different, and that's what I would like us to try to think about. So I just want to open it up and think about, for those of you who parent or grandparent, or those of you who are young people in the culture, who work with young people in the culture, what are the dominant images that we contend with, that where we see some clashes between values that we hold and what the culture is teaching, encouraging, drawing people into? And I just ask some people to be willing to share.
I guess I call it induced debt or poverty. Wages have no bearing on it. A couple could be making $100,000 a year, but because of the material things they buy, their basics are in poverty.
Okay. So you're talking about the cultural norm of earning more, making more, succeeding, buying more, but it really does not meet those essential needs that families have for relationship and other things. It's what I referred to earlier as, I call that the poverty of affluence.
Right.
That we can have all the material needs met, but we may be doing a terrible job with our children or with children in our culture. Thank you. Other examples? Yes?
I heard someone talk about the Amish recently, and it was why they make the choices they do, and I just simply thought that they were anti-modern maybe or something, but their choices are based on what keeps families or their culture in community. And I find so much of what's drawing our children away from our family is broadly an anti-community emphasis.
Yeah.
That leads our, especially our 12 and 15-year-old daughter to just to turn their backs on us.
And what's the draw for that? What are they being asked to participate in? Where do you see that specifically? I agree with you. Absolutely. I have a whole chapter in this book, Families Valued, on I define the essential problem that we face in this culture, but I think even broader than that is the breakdown or absence of community. And on tomorrow, one of the things I want to talk a lot about is how can we, as people who work with children or as families, how can we respond to that? How can community be an important piece of that? But if I could just encourage you a little bit to say some of the specific things that you find most troubling that your 12-year-old, 15-year-old are being attracted to. Yes?
And I'm the father of those children. Well, they're drawn to the mall. They're drawn to go to the store to look at to purchase clothing that their peers are wearing.
So the mall, the clothes, the brand names.
And just the social awareness of beauty of maybe not beauty, but how you look is problematic.
Yeah. So I'm really trying to conform to what I mentioned last night of, you know, try to resist peer pressure, and there's so much peer pressure around how we look and how we dress and what labels we wear and those kinds of things.
And I see it for boys, it's been drawn to the video games and just all the game boys. these computer games.
Yeah, and what's the what's the content of those games?
Violence.
Well, we aren't there yet, but yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. But also, they're just so antisocial, sociable. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we mentioned in a previous session that the television and the video game and the computer screen can be problematic, probably for a lot of reasons, but two of them that I think are most notable are it's a means of communication where we are static. We're watching. Although in video games you have some sense of participation, but it's participation with a screen. It's very different from human interaction. And then it's the content as well of those video games. And we're going to come back to that later on, because one of the issues that I specifically want to address today is looking at the issue of violence. So let's get a few more. Yeah.
What I wanted to say is I think what some families have lost is the ability to play together. Mm-hmm. That if it's a priority, if you say you're not going out tonight with your friends, we're playing games, we're going to shoot baskets, whatever it is, that you as a family say, you can go out tomorrow night or whatever it is, but this is our family time, because it isn't necessarily the game itself, but it is the interaction that you have with those kids. They know that you care enough to set out of your schedule that you're not going to answer the phone, you're not going to wash dishes, you're not going to do all those other kinds of things. You're going to say, I'm setting aside a time and we're going to play together. So figure out what that is, if it's a bike ride or whatever, but though I think we need more of that every day instead of have those be the sparse things. But that, and kids, especially teenagers, are going to be very reluctant to want to do that. And my kids, I'm always dragging them on their bikes, but we just do it. It's just expected and required, and it might mean that you go to the Dairy Queen if that's their, you know, whatever the draw is. But as a way to say, we need to spend, you know, time together, then you can talk about things that you might not ordinarily talk about because you don't have the time.
Before I get to another, let me just respond to that. I mean, just try to summarize it and play on it a little bit. Is Robin suggesting that the breakdown of family time and play time, and in our culture, it probably really is a good idea to schedule it and hold to it, because otherwise it won't happen. And I think one of the great temptations of parenting in this day and age is that we overschedule our kids, and that they're involved in so many things that it actually contributes then to the absence of having time as a family. And I think where that gets reflected in addition to playtime is meal time. I mean, I it's one of the things I actually miss being here at Holden Village, because in a way it's such a wonderful and it's a free space and it's a place where people are out. But I miss having sit-down meals with my family, and those are the kind of the check-in times where we find out how we're doing. And so apart from here, we'll get back to that, but it's a very important thing, this time element with families. Yeah, we got one here, and we got a bunch, so we'll keep going around.
Just further to our last comment, we know a Mormon family very well, and one of their big premises, of course, is family. And what they do is they set aside a night during the week in which the family gets together. And they do Bible study, or they go out and ski, or whatever. And I think that's a wonderful attribute to that particular faith.
And if it's not structured in some way, it'll probably fall through the cracks. I mean, I think that's there's so many things going on in the culture that we're invited to do, that unless we set some priorities, it's probably difficult to make happen. Yeah.
I had an interesting thing. We were sitting, myself and some other adults, in the sauna the other night, and five teenagers came in with us, and it was a mixed group of boys and girls. And they started in on this body image discussion, discussing, the little girls were sitting over and saying, oh my gosh, look at this roll of fat. And I was like, yeah, wait until you're 35 and have a child. but I'm a health professional, and it was interesting for me because I try in my teaching of adults to get them to understand body fat and the difference between weight and that kind of thing. And to listen to 13-year-olds talk well about body fat and body composition was a scary thing for me because I thought, you shouldn't understand that at this point. At 13, you should not be worried about what your body fat composition is. And so that was a scary thing. And of course, they left, and the rest of us women in there were like, oh my God,
But in eighth grade, they were tested for body fat. My daughter came home
and you're kidding
tested
me.
At school in PE with no choice about it, worrying because her body fat reading with this very, what seemed unscientific, little pinch of the arm. I don't know. It took me a long time to interpret that to her. And I did call the school and talk to the PE instructor, and oh, that's not our intention, it's about good eating and everything. I said, get missed.
Teach good
all
eating.
They heard was body fat. And they looked at the ratios, and there's a range, let's say 17, 23, 44, and she's looking, well, she's 2% lower body fat than me. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why is this an issue?
Yeah.
I didn't introduce this to you.
No.
The school did, in the auspices of trying to
help.
Good help. Right. And we worked and worked and worked. She's 16 now, and I think it's got pretty healthy, you know, feelings about her body as an instrument, not an object.
Right.
And that's just one thing I'd interject is that our media culture has made bodies for girls an object as opposed to an instrument.
So, just to carry on with that, I work in an ER, pediatric ER, and I weigh kids in the course of figuring out medications for them. And we weigh in kilograms. And so I usually just take it as a number and put it down. But I can't tell you how many mothers are, oh, but how many pounds is that? So as a parent, too, I think we have to be really careful that we aren't turning it around. And then they ask the question, well, how are they doing? As if I have growth and development charts. I mean, I'm interested in the laceration on their face. And so I have to really be careful to just really downplay that. And I try to just take a weight in kilograms and never even respond to it. But parents are also very bad at wanting to know, what does that mean? And how many pounds exactly is that?
Indeed. I wonder if I think that preoccupation with parents comes from an internalization of the culture or the fears of that my child is going to be picked on because that's part of the culture. It's probably coming from a lot of places, but it still has, even when you're trying to do something positive, thinking about health, the image that you may actually communicate may be very different than that. Go ahead, Sarah, and then over
well,
here.
I was just going to say, I think a big concern I have is that people aren't asking kids to do. You know, they're telling kids that they need something, as opposed to be a helper, be a volunteer, do something in your community, do something in your school, do something anywhere. And instead, it's you need something. You're not perfect. You need this, that, and the other thing. Instead of you have so much to offer.
One of the stories that I tell in this book really hits on that point. When Sarah and I lived and worked in Nicaragua in part of the 1980s, and I don't know how much you know about Nicaragua, but it was in the midst of trying to bring about a lot of changes, and it had a literacy crusade, and young people were very, very much involved in everything. They were teaching people to read all over the country, and they were involved in harvesting, and then the war started to take a toll. And I remember meeting with a Catholic priest who was one of my favorite people that I met in Nicaragua. Fernando Cardenal is his name. And he had been the minister of education for this new government. And I was with a group of U.S. people who were meeting with him, and he was just kind of lamenting that he was afraid that they were asking young people to do too much in Nicaragua, and that they were going to get worn out and worn down. And then he kind of shook his head and said, but you know, the problem in your country is way worse because you don't ask young people to do anything. You don't give them a vision of life for themselves. You don't invite them to participate in and to see themselves as people who are able to address pressing problems, can help make their communities better, etc. So I think it's a really, really good point.
Just to go way back.
Which is probably why we're married. No.
Go back to one of your comments about family mealtime. Not only to have family mealtime, but to have the TV off. And what I find in my household is that even though I am consistent about the TV being off at dinner time, that both my husband and my daughter race to get the food into their mouth so they can get back to their TV shows, and one is upstairs and one is downstairs.
Wow.
And it just drives me crazy, and that will be probably the biggest cause of my sobbing as I leave here tomorrow, is that we have to go back and face that square thing. And I don't know how to. I think what I'm going to do is set a timer and tell them that they can't leave the table until
my mom goes up. Oh, really? But listening to Robin, in my family, when I grew up, there were. It didn't matter whether it was 3:30 in the afternoon or 9 o'clock at night. The family ate together. And when we were young, we took early naps so we could wait till my dad got home, or we ate early. And we thought we died and went to heaven when I got to college, and there was finally a tiny black and white TV that made its way to the kitchen. But we never, but we did, we had to. I mean, you could eat as fast as you want, but the family sat at the table for 30 minutes. So if your food was gone, you sat there until the family got done. And then there were days during the week that were designated. And Sunday was a family day, and this day we did this. And I can remember hating it for a period of time, and then I just kind of gave into it, and it became a way of like, oh yeah, the Nichols are doing, you know, it's Tuesday night, the Nichols can't play, or it's Saturday, the Nichols are going. And then summers, we had 1 week out of the entire summer that we could do the normal malls and stuff like that, and by Tuesday, I was so tired of it that I was like, I'm gonna get back to camp or do something. So I think it's the norm that you start from a very, very early age, what's expected, and then it becomes normal for the family.
Now, and I'm curious as to how do you think it happened that the TV became so central in your home? Because it really does sound like it's occupying a place that you don't want it to, certainly.
I haven't missed it at all. That's a good question, and one that I've asked myself, how did this happen? What? And I think as far as my daughter is concerned, is that when we get home, she's been at daycare because I do work, I pick her up and I want to get dinner on the table, and she wants to watch TV.
Yeah.
Okay, go watch TV and then I'll get dinner started.
It's a pattern that when it's started, it's hard to break. I know. Sarah, and you wanted to say something. Go ahead, and then I'll make my comment. No, way back in there.
I've read a book by Leonard Schlain on the alphabet and the goddess. And he makes the point that pre-literate cultures embodied communication methods that were story. People told stories. And then along came the human achievement of letters and alphabet, letters, writing. And his thesis was that that has changed the way we think. That primarily an oral culture uses both sides of the brain, probably more so your right side, the synthetic side, the side that includes feelings and imagination and but when we became a literate society, became left brain dominant. Everything became linear and logical, and it revolutionized how we live together, and for good and bad. It's been very good to be a literate society.
It's very interesting, because the way I normally think about it is that, you know, we used to communicate by storytelling. You know, when we have the written word, then we can pass those stories on, not just talking to each other, but now we have TVs talking to us. Mm-hmm. And they're telling us not the stories that link us to the past and link us to communities. They're telling us essentially stories of violence and sex and stuff. And why do they tell us those stories? What pays for television?
The commercials.
The commercials, right? And I think that's one of the links that I'm going to try to make today, and I don't know how much time we'll have to talk about it, but I think we need to understand that we need to worry about the images that are conveyed through television and movies and videos, but that what the violence and the sex are meant to do is they're meant to sell.
I mean, they're the things that bring us to the marketplace so that they can present us with the items that we're expected to go out and buy. That's the role that they play.
Part of the appeal then, I'm thinking of your question, why is it appealing? And part of the appeal is that it does use the right side of your brain. You're visualizing as you hear the story, so that it employs a strategy that we are comfortable, in fact, like to have that both sides of our brain used, so that
it
has a good use. It can be a very powerful means of communication well, but it needs to, that sense of content has to be critiqued.
Yeah. I mean, last week, in the teaching I did on U.S. foreign policy, I used a couple of segments of videos, and I know how much more powerful some visual images are. But as you say, if the content of those visual images is trash, then it's awakening both parts of your brain, but not to a good purpose. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on television, not just the violence part. My children are sort of limited because I make them watch only PBS. And like it or lump it, that's what they watch. But the TV's in our, the only TV we have is a 19-inch in my bedroom. So there's no way they can sneak off into the anywhere and watch it. But what I was going to say is that my daughter will, now that she's almost 15, will turn on whatever's on, and she'll I'll sit and just check it out. And a lot of it's just real disrespectful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just violence and bad jokes and innuendos on sexual things and stuff like that, but it's also a lot of just disrespect for adults and where do the little girls, 15-year-olds, get their body image? It's all on that dumb show, and they're all disrespectful and telling nasty jokes, et cetera, et cetera. I object to that, besides the violence.
We take another one, and I would just like to ask on this one, what strategies have people used to try to limit the negative cultural impact of television, for example? Let's just see what people have done.
Well, we have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old, and we do the PBS thing too, but a friend of ours, I realized one day, was calling TV mind candy, and so that's a good way for me even to teach the kids that even if it's good stuff, you know, or even if it's enjoyable stuff, you don't watch it all the time, or you don't treat it as your main mind diet, because you want a little bit more than that. So even if it's a good show, it's just the candy, you know, it's just the extras. We don't do it all alone.
Yeah.
What I try to do is talk about what was seen. See it like a movie. We don't watch TV at all. We rarely modeled it for them. And so that's just become a non-issue most of the time. But if we do go to a movie or watch a video,
then you process it.
Yeah, think about what was said. But that's hard to do.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing, that it's viewing with your child or your children. It's also putting limits and saying, you may watch a half an hour this week. And they just say, hello, you know, especially at teenagers. And you say, that's your choice. So look at what the selections are, and let's talk about it. This is the show you want to watch, and then let's watch it together. And so that you're not, it's who runs the house is what I want to say. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a mind that you're dealing with, a very precious mind. Mm-hmm. So you just limit it and say, these are the choices, and help the children wisely.
Well, we have a son that's split between two houses, and it sounds really limited compared to what you guys have, but we don't have cable in our house. The other place has cable, so we're kind of like the bad people because we don't have 64 channels. We have 5 channels.
Sounds good.
He really likes the mind candy
play. It creates very difficult dynamics. I mean, I think that's one of the real difficult things about split families is that dynamic. I see my brother is divorced and his kids, he shares custody. And they're very different styles of parenting and very different things available. And it's a very difficult, troubling dynamic. Yeah.
We've cut our cable completely. We don't watch TV at all.
And I didn't have that when I was raising children, but I wish I had had the courage to do that at that time.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have a TV. Sarah and I didn't have a TV for a long time. And then after my father died a few years later, my mother remarried a TV repairman. he'd drop off a TV, and the next time he'd come down, it'd be gone. And then he'd bring us another one. And finally we kept one. But and we watch occasionally, but our kids watch almost no TV, and we watch almost no TV with the kids, or we just don't watch much TV. And it's kind of the joke, we're the joke in a nice way of all of the public libraries in Minneapolis, because every 2.5 weeks we come in literally with our laundry basket, and we fill them up with about 90 books. And so our kids, who are ages 6, 9, and 11, we read 90 books every 2.5 weeks. So
we
now
just have a running fine.
We've done pretty well of keeping track. And I think it is very interesting to watch the impact of that. And there's positive impacts and negative impacts. Most of them positive in my view. But the positive impacts are, I think our children are very creative. And, you know, our oldest child never has trouble thinking of something to do. She's always creating this and that. And I think that's related, because it isn't being talked to all the time, so therefore you are creating in your world. The negative impact is just simply how difficult it sometimes can be, and probably will be as they get older. You know, I remember Hannah coming back, I don't remember which grade it was, fourth grade, fifth grade. You know, I'm the only kid who's never seen The Lion King. You know, because we don't do that, and because the culture is so embraced in that, it means that many of the conversations that are going on around her are involving characters she has no clue who they are. And as a result, she gets isolated. And it's a very, very difficult problem. So that tomorrow, well, depending upon what we talk about today, but tomorrow one of the things I want to address a little bit is that's one of the things that for me makes alternative community really important. And expanding the linkages that our children have with other children and adults who are sharing somewhat similar values and some similar questions about how to live in relation to the culture. Others, are there other people? Yes.
You just had a gentleman speak at our church at a men's gathering a couple weeks ago who was a media watcher. He's a national, his name is Ted Baer. And he laid some statistics on us that were surprising to us. There's an increasing number of Christians involved in media in Hollywood. We're near the Hollywood area in the filmmaking industry. And he said, it's important to know that there is an increasing influence of the Christian community on media and actual production of film. That he's been called upon, like Prince of Egypt, that animated piece that Spielberg did. Spielberg asked him to bring in the clergy to consult on the movie so that they could have that as good as they could get it, as accurate as they could get it. And his point was, you know, to watch critically, as everyone is saying here, and to teach in our church. We're going to bring him back and have him teach us how to watch with our kids, you know. But the other side of the coin is that the Christian influence is increasingly being felt in Hollywood. And he said that's important to note as well, that you can't just say leave the media culture behind, that somebody's got to invade that culture, and that's also happening. And that was an encouraging thing to hear.
And I think as we do that, just as in Barb's Bible studies and other things, I think we have to figure out what is the Christian take that we want to bring to that table. Because there's going to be lots of different views about what a responsible media will look like. And many of them I would probably find about as frightening as what already exists. So I think it's a place where we really have to engage again the whole idea of what is our understanding of faith, what images do we want to draw on. But I think that's a very important place. I asked Barb a question in relation to Bible study today. It seems to me that in Jesus' time, you had a really clear option when the Essenes just decided you can't be people of faith in society. And they just withdrew into the desert. and that Jesus didn't take that option. Jesus really addresses the domination system of his time and all of its cultural and political and economic images head on, and that's why he got killed. But he gives us a lot, I think, of food for thought and guidance about how to engage the world. So I don't necessarily think that just, you know, throwing away every TV set is the answer. So we have to be engaged at multiple levels. I think that's a really good point. Yes?
I was wanting to get back to the question that you were asking about language and the effect on children. I'm on the staff in elementary school, and we've been hearing an increasing amount of, well, not only foul language, but particularly put-downs that children are learning directly from television, from South Park, and programs like that. And they use it, and it, what happens is that it's very hurtful to other children because it's so sarcastic and so negative. And we've been trying to come up with strategies to teach children what the effect of that kind of language is on others and how to avoid using that. And that's a real challenge that we've seen. And I guess it's a matter for not only the school, but for families. And I have to wonder, when you look at violence in the society, there was some talk after the Littleton shootings about the fact that there was isolation, that there were put-downs, that there was a sense in which those who were on the fringes or marginalized in this group felt outside of the mainstream, outside of the popular group or the in-group at the school, and were made to feel that way because of comments that had been.
If you'll allow me, if you give me just a few minutes, I would like to take that thought and run with it a little bit in a couple different directions, and then we'll still have some time for conversation. It triggers a couple things. One is our community, Sarah and I and Robin and Kathleen and a number of other people here, are part of an ecumenical faith community in Minneapolis called the Community of St. Martin. Actually grew out of Holden Village, grew out of some people who were staff people here who moved to Minneapolis. And this community is now a dozen years old or so. And each summer, some members of our community put on something called Peace Village for neighborhood children. And the curriculum, it can includes a number of things, but one of them that it's included has been media literacy. And so trying to watch with children and show them advertisements and show them different programming and really critique it and try to get across what messages are really being sent and are they authentic and real. And I think that's a really worthwhile thing. And another part of the curriculum has been how to resolve conflicts without violence. So teaching children skills of nonviolent conflict resolution. That triggers my second thought, which is that I think around the country, some of the best work that's going on about these issues is actually in the public schools. And in our public school, for example, our children attend public school in Minneapolis that happens to be a Montessori school. It's grades K through 8, and they start from day one in every classroom talking about respect, talking about building respect for diversity, laying out parameters of what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable behavior. There's a zero tolerance for violence. There's a RAP program where students in each class select representatives who, that when there is a conflict between children in the school, they can go to one of these other students, sit down with them, and there's a format that they work through this conflict. And the rule is that you won't get in trouble if you've been in conflict with another student, if you can work it out through this kind of mediation. And then there's always teachers and others in the background who are occasionally called upon. But this program is tremendous, and it really has an impact on the school. And one of the local news channels recently did a piece on it, And they mentioned as part of that that this year at our school there hasn't been one incidence of violence and not one incidence in which a student had to be expelled from school.
Or suspended.
Or suspended from school. So this is a, you know, a public school with incredible diversity, and which half of the students in Minneapolis public schools are living below the poverty line, bringing in some of them enormous problems that result as a result of that. So I think there are some very, very good things that are going on. I'll mention another one. And this one I haven't seen, but I talk about in the book a little bit, is there's a Quaker school in Philadelphia that started a program in which they decided to introduce young children from kindergarten on up through high school, their program goes, in which they literally bring babies into the classroom. And they bring young children into the classroom. They go in kind of stages. And the kindergartners and the first graders and the senior high all have interactions with babies and young children. And they talk about the development that they see along the way in these children. And they learn about how hard it is to take care of children. Well, to make a long story short, what they discovered is that students who attend this school have a dramatic reduction in teen pregnancies, have an huge, huge decline in male violence. Because what they're doing at a very early age and then nurturing it throughout is they're bringing out that impulse that exists in young boys in particular, which is a very nurturing impulse that comes out in the context of with young children. Now, in that environment, what I would like to raise up, lift up for you is the issue of particularly men and violence in a culture of violence. 89% of all violent crimes in our country are done by men. And the question is, why? Why does that happen? And I would like to introduce you to a book, and again, you can find quotations in here from some of them, if it's helpful. But if you're raising daughters, then I would suggest you read a book called Reviving Ophelia. Some of you, I forget the author's name. Does anybody have that?
Mary Pfeiffer.
Mary Pfeiffer. Very challenging book, an excellent book, and one that everyone should read. If you're raising sons, then I would encourage you to read a book called Boys Will Be Boys. It's by a woman named, I'll write it up here, Miriam Medzian.
Boys Will Be Boys.
And what her thesis in this book, in a nutshell, again, you can find a more complete description in this book if you want. Her thesis is that almost all studies indicate that genetically boys are slightly more prone to violence than girls. That it's part of, you know, I talked to some people last week who said, well, I know you wrote this book and it's really good, but you wrote it, you didn't have a son. That's completely different. No, he didn't say it was completely different, but there are different dynamics, I think. And what she says, in a nutshell, is that we should acknowledge those differences and therefore try to deal with some of those. And instead what we do is in our culture we reinforce the tendency towards violence at every turn. And so that as a culture and in our cartoons, in our video games, in most of the storylines of our movies, all in clothes and toys, in all aspects of life, we are, in a sense, identifying a problem, but rather than dealing with the problem, it would be like giving an alcohol unlimited access to alcohol. And that's what we're doing. And I think that this whole issue of men in violence is a really challenging one, particularly in this culture. And there's I have a chapter in Families Valued that deals with that. But I wanted to take this in, we've got a few more minutes there, one more direction. I would like you to relive for me a Popeye cartoon. Let's see if we can remember the characters, a typical plot line, and with the outcome. What's a Popeye cartoon?
Well, his foe's name is Brutus, so you already okay. know that you're in trouble.
So Brutus is
he just tries to get the girl Popeye.
Olive.
Get the spinach in his bicep.
Yeah.
Okay. So the characters are Brutus and Popeye.
Sweet pea
and
who's the burger guy?
The guy wants to be Wimpy. Wants to eat the burger.
Yeah.
And the storyline, usually in the beginning of the story, what happens? Brutus is doing what? Okay, but
he takes Olive. He wants
okay,
Olive.
Okay, takes Olive. Okay, right. So there's this conflict. Brutus has Olive Oil and is obviously going to do something bad to her, going to rape her or hurt her, threatening her. And then Popeye steps in, and what happens initially?
He gets beat up.
He just gets pummeled, right? He gets pummeled. But then he eats his spinach, and then what happens?
Then he pummels
Brutus. The conflict is resolved for this episode, and then it happens over and over again. Now, what Walter Wink, who's a New Testament professor of mine, and who has written, I think, some of the most compelling stuff about Jesus and nonviolence, he points out that Popeye cartoon really transfers the oldest myth in history that is present in almost every society, in almost every mythological tale told. And it's the myth of redemptive violence, the myth that violence saves. So he's saying that we've built into our very cartoons and most programs, not only violence, but the idea that violence saves. And so we are creating, in a sense, in our children at very deep levels early on something that this notion that there is no alternative to violence. There is no nonviolent conflict resolution options. This is just the way things work. And I think that's a very challenging way to look at our culture. So now we have problems with violence that we're surrounding our children, and particularly young boys who may be a little more prone to violence than young girls are, although girls are not immune to violence. That's not the point that this book makes. We surround them with violent images. We also surround them with a mythology that violence saves. Now, Wink acknowledges that we seem to be entering a somewhat of a new stage. And the new stage is that now the media is more intent on just bringing us violence. That even the mythology of redemptive violence isn't always the central, it's featured in many, many, many cases. But we now have many horror flicks just where violence itself is the gratification. And that's I think, even a further diminishment of the culture. So there's a relationship in my mind between Popeye cartoons and the cultural images and Littleton. There's also a relationship for me, and this is a more controversial one. I don't know for how many of you this was striking. But it was very striking for me to have President Clinton come on. What am I going to say? You say it.
He came on and gave this speech. I was watching it on CNN, and he gave this speech on how it was meant for kids to watch and how violence was not a way to solve your problems. And then the next thing they flashed was scenes from Kosovo.
Right. Exactly. You caught it exactly. And that message is not lost on our children, that the President of the United States can come on and lament Littleton and say, you know, we've got to find other ways to solve conflicts. We've got to find nonviolent ways. And meanwhile, he's just bypassed the United Nations, and is engaged in a bombing campaign that is a violation of international law. So those messages are related also, yes?
I think as striking as that message is also his very lame apology when we bombed the China embassy. I was embarrassed when I heard that. Yeah, we made a mistake, but when you compare it to all the damage that what's going on to Kosovo, it's minor. And I truly was embarrassed because I thought that was so lame. Instead of just coming out and said, we made a tragic mistake and we did kill innocent people. There's nothing we can do to bring them back. I don't know what you could have said before that, but what he said was terrible. And again, I think it underscores that violence is okay if you compare it to something worse. You know, I only killed one person. How come you're not persecuting a serial killer? You know, something like that.
And this is a very difficult issue to talk about in our culture, and it's a very difficult issue for Christians to talk about, because the claim I would make, I don't know how many of you were here last week, not many of you, I don't think. If you want, and obviously only if you want, the last session I did a whole week on U.S. foreign policy. I didn't tape them all. I think I taped three sessions last week. But you might find those interesting. But particularly the last one, and the last one, which was, I believe I did on Saturday of last week, I did a session in which I looked at biblical images of God. And I made a case that what proves that God is God throughout much of the biblical story is superior violence. That's what makes God God. That there was a lot of competition over who God was. And if you read the Exodus account, if you read it carefully, it really says that God is God because of superior violence. And that the overwhelming expectation of salvation, if you read the Psalms, the overwhelming expectation is the crushing defeat of enemies. Now, you can listen to that tape, but the point I was making is I was bringing us up to Jesus, and that Jesus really introduced something radically different in his own context, in his own Jewish context. And that was that he introduced us to the nonviolence of God. And it's an image which very few Christians, I think, have been willing to embrace or even talk or think about seriously. So if you're at all intrigued by even what that might mean, I think it has great relevance for this notion of what does it mean to come out of empire that's been part of the Bible studies over the last couple of weeks. And it has a lot of relevance for how do we make our way in the world in the midst of a culture that oftentimes is hostile. What values do we bring? And I would say if we're going to be faithful to Jesus, that one of the things we would need to do is to take the love of enemies really seriously. And I took a look at the passage in which Jesus spoke about love of enemies. He gives three really concrete examples of what that means in practice. So I think I'll close today with this idea of maybe this whole issue of violence and how we're to live in relation to culture may be precisely the kinds of issues that Jesus posed. I'm not going to repeat that session, but if you're interested, that one did get taped. And just to say that tomorrow in our last session, which I think is at 5 o'clock tomorrow, if you can come back, I would really like to talk further about how is it that we can engage the world and engage injustices as families. How can we build partnerships with our children? Because I'll tell you, I'll close on this note. My parents, and I love them dearly, my father's now dead, for very well-intentioned reasons, what their hope for their children was to isolate them from the world. They specifically moved us to a suburb where they knew or hoped we wouldn't have to deal with problems of poverty and racial divisions and other things. I bitterly resented them for that as soon as my world began to open up, which didn't take too long. And so as a parent, I walk a really fine line, and this book really struggles with that, if you're interested. I walk a really fine line of, I don't want to overwhelm my children with the world, but I don't want to hide them from it either. And so what I'd really like to wrestle with you with out loud, and what I wrestle with in this book, is how do we parent responsibly? How do we relate to children responsibly in a world that has a lot of injustice? How is it that we can do that? And how can we partner with our children to have them involved and see themselves as important actors in their communities that will get rid of some of that feeling of powerlessness and alienation that I think feeds the mall culture and feeds a lot of those things? By the way, if you are interested, they did not get these in the bookstore. If you're at all interested in this book that I wrote, Family Values, just write a check to me for $11.50, write on there Families Valued, and I will send it out to you next week. So, thank you. We'll close this session for now.
Thank you.